Chapter 14. On the 20th of February 1968, Connie and I were joined together at the Unitarian Church in Manhattan at a warm, friendly little service with about 15 friends present. The only moment of disappointment came at the very end of the service when I discovered I'd failed to excise one particular mention of the word God. I can still remember how Connie looked just as the minister gave us his permission to kiss. Everything felt very right. We decided to travel to London by boat, and it was the tranquillity of life on board the Queen Elizabeth that made me realise just how frantic my life had become over the past couple of years. I had experienced being lived by my life, as they say, rather than living it. It was a busyness that made me feel out of control. I had never thought of myself as particularly driven. Yet I was now working on something every day, and the little spare time that remained was then immediately filled by a mass of petty obligations that I resented but seemed powerless to control. When I'd first been in New York, at Square East and then in Half a Sixpence, I'd spent most of my day reading, going to art galleries, taking exercise, seeing films, exploring the city, eating with friends. I always had great chunks of time for myself. Now, in London, I had to plan a week ahead if I wanted to get my hair cut. I discovered that the price of free time was eternal vigilance. I felt that if I turned my back, someone would write an appointment in my diary. I could see, though not as clearly as I do now, that one of my biggest problems was me. Because I wanted everyone to like me and to approve of me, I tried to be nice to everyone all the time, and this proved a remarkably efficient way of losing control over my life. Connie noticed this very quickly after we'd been in London a few months. She gave me some good advice. She said, "Don't feel like you have to greet every waiter as though he's a long-lost friend. And when we go for dinner at someone else's house, don't take over the role of the host." What's more, being very nice was pretty tiring, so I often became tetchy, in as nice a way as possible, of course, which meant that I had to be twice as nice the next day to prove how nice I really was. Consequently, I hardly ever dared to say a polite but firm no to anyone. And this brought me a second problem. Because when the only people who are going to ask you for time-consuming favours or invite you to boring events are your friends and relations, it's possible to control things. But once you become even a minor celebrity, you're faced with a constant deluge of requests for autographs, photographs, personal effects that can be auctioned, mementos, locks of hair, speeches, advice on how to get into show business, money for charities, money to help people through university, money for operations, money for people who are down on their luck, quick chats over coffee about comedy, messages to children to encourage them before their exams, requests from student magazines for interviews, and for lists of my top 10 books, films, songs, comedians, holiday resorts, wines, footballers, ways to be happy, most embarrassing moments, cocktails, walks in the Lake District, national flags, cheeses, cars, and operations. Also, for help with finding an agent, for meetings with seven-year-olds who are my biggest fans, jokes for best man speeches, recommendations of speech therapists in the Weston-super-Mare area, introductions to Ronnie Corbett, confirmation that I used to know a particular person, that it really was me in Beckles Town Hall snooker room on the 23rd of February 1959, and for explanations why a sketch in the 1948 show had used the phrase one-up the Jaxie, why my parents had chosen to send me to Eton, why I was such an ardent Quaker, how it was that I'd stopped collecting death masks, why I had climbed K2 so frequently, and why I had finally agreed to play Othello. By now, I had a 6 hours a week secretary, and when we had conscientiously worked through these requests and questions, we had to turn to deal with the invitations I'd received to speak at school sports day, at university unions, Rotary luncheons, at retired railwaymen clubs, at drama colleges, at police dinners and political meetings, and to judge essay competitions, Weston-super-Mare beauty pageants, fancy dress outfits, student plays, tug-of-war contests, and carved vegetable competitions. and to attend weddings, anniversaries, prize givings, birthday parties, centenaries, summer fetes, Labour Party rallies, Conservative Party rallies, Liberal Party rallies, Plaid Cymru rallies, car rallies, art gallery openings, amateur theatrical first nights, Barrow Inverness Methodist Pigeon Fanciers Wine and Cheese Family Evenings, short film festivals, medium-length film festivals, crematorium openings, children's parties, brass band galas, water sports conventions, local history exhibitions, coronations, and my personal all-time favourite, an invitation to go to Melton Mowbray to attend the christening of somebody's cat. And I want to emphasise that every single request or invitation came from really nice, polite, friendly people. Mind you, I've only ever seen one rude invitation. It was from the Dundee Students' Union to Her Majesty the Queen, informing her that they had decided to invite her to visit Dundee University by 13-9. So I agonised over every single response, never saying, sorry, I'm too busy, because that might seem rather rude, but instead explaining how busy I was at present, but that perhaps in a few months I might, etc., etc., thus merely postponing the decision and piling up half-promises to the point where simply doing away with myself seemed the easiest solution. A lot of these requests came from charities. Now, I never met a charity I didn't like. I used to look askance at the Association for the Aid of Distressed Gentlefolk, but was eventually persuaded of its vital importance. The problem was that there were over 60,000 active charities in the UK. So seriously, how do you say yes to cancer and no to spina bifida? Every day, opening my post presented me with a series of Sophie's choices. And all this agonising, this ridiculous time-wasting, was because it took me another 30 years to learn that if you say no, in a friendly, chatty way, people accept it with great good grace and goodwill and do not hate you, or send squads after you, or report you to the Daily Mail. And until I realised this, I found myself resenting perfectly amiable request simply because I was incapable of a guilt-free no. Nowadays, I have a simple rule. You can ask me anything you like, provided I can say no. I've also learned from nightclub bouncers that there are just as effective ways of refusing people's demands that are less personally confrontational. When a bouncer is told, I am a close personal friend of Mick Jagger, and he's invited me to his birthday party this evening, but I've mislaid my invitation, and I have a couple of tickets for the Wimbledon final that his wife gave me just now to give to him personally. Will you let me in? He will reply, I'm afraid that isn't going to happen, sir. This impersonal style presents the no as though it is a law of physics. I'm sorry, sir, but unfortunately, entropy, that is, microscopic disorder of a body, cannot ever decrease, and there's nothing I can do about it, sorry. So I use a variant of this ploy when people suddenly appear at my elbow, asking for a photograph with me. I'm really not sure why this sorry to interrupt you, but can I have a picture with you irritates me so much. Perhaps it's the idea of providing photographic proof for the rest of eternity of the moment that I stood next to someone I'd never set eyes on before. In the past, I have to confess, I sometimes responded to the request by saying, what, to commemorate the fact we met 4 seconds ago? But now I've taken to replying, I'm sorry, but I'm afraid I don't do that, delivering the line with a fatalistic smile that hints that the interloper is asking me to betray some deeply held religious principle, and that the matter is consequently out of my hands. This has failed only once at a South African airport in 2013 when it infuriated a middle-aged man so much that he wrote to the Cape Argus about it. In the old days, people would ask for a photograph of you, but now it's always, always with you, presumably so that they can then tell their friends, look, there's me with, what's his name, Barack Obama. I truly believe that the worst aspect of the whole celebrity merry-go-round is the belief that your life becomes more meaningful because you have touched the hem of Simon Cowell's garment, or the true wisdom involves knowing the name of Steven Seagal's nanny's dog. I feel a lot better for that. So, anyway, where was I? Oh, yes! On the Queen Elizabeth, with Connie, thinking about why my life had become too busy. So far as work was concerned, I knew that I was not driven by some great ambition. My horizons were, in fact, surprisingly constrained. I wanted to gain increasing artistic control over the television programs I did, but I did not yearn for the John Cleese show. I much preferred to be an influential member of a small team so that I had a lot of control over the material and how it was presented, but not total responsibility. And I wanted the shows to be as funny as we could make them, because I had by then realized that it was much easier in comedy to be clever than it was to be funny. And, as my experience in performing in Half a Sixpence had shown me, I had no ambition to act in the theatre between Half a Sixpence and the Alimony Tour, 46 years. I only performed on stage in the Amnesty and Monty Python shows. So far as films were concerned, they weren't on my radar screen at all. They existed in a separate universe from mine, and never the twain would meet. So I was myopically focused on British television, of which I was inordinately proud, since it was clearly the best in the world, or, as someone claimed, the least bad in the world. Anyway, after 5 days of an enticingly tranquil voyage, Connie and I landed at Southampton, made our way to London, and moved into a flat I'd found for us in Knightsbridge. It was on the fifth floor of an attractive 1920s apartment block between the Knightsbridge fire station and Harrods on Basil Street. Yes, Basil Street. Now, when people hear this, they quite naturally say, "Oh, so that's why you called him Basil." Well, I'm sorry, but I don't think so. By the time we were writing 40 Towers, we were long gone from Knightsbridge, and I know we never made the connection consciously. And believe me, it is quite possible that these things are coincidental. For example, everyone who worked for Sir Charles Forte assumed that Faulty was a reference to Trust House Forte Hotels and Restaurant. Had that occurred to you? It didn't to me. And take Basil's initials, BF. For my father's generation, was one of the rudest things that well-mannered people could say about a man. It meant bloody fool. Again, it never crossed my mind. A final example. It only dawned on me when I started to write this book that two of my most successful appearances have been in shows with circus in the title. Now, if you say, "Oh, come on, you must have been influenced unconsciously by Basil Street," admit it, I will reply, "Well, if I was influenced unconsciously, then by definition I wouldn't know about it, would I? But I don't think so, and it's my life we're talking about, not yours. And if it were yours, I would defer to you because you know a lot more about it than I do. And perhaps I'm writing this book because book begins with a B and so does Basil, which was a success. So unconsciously I'm hoping a book will bring me success, whereas screenplay begins with an S like Sybil, and Basil's relationship with her was a disaster, and that's pushed me towards television." And you will say, "No, that's not a fair example." And I will say, "Yes, it is. Now, will you please stop interrupting me and let me get on with recording the fucking thing?" Our new flat was superbly located, 2 minutes' walk from Knightsbridge Tube Station and a 15-minute taxi ride from almost everywhere that I wanted to go. Gradually, we settled into married life, and I introduced Connie to my friends, and they all took to her immediately. She, however, found one thing about them rather puzzling. She kept it to herself until one evening when we were returning from a dinner party, and she asked me why, although they were perfectly at ease answering her questions about them, they never asked her any questions about herself. It took me a while to figure this out, and then I had an epiphany. The reason was that the English middle class are so terrified of embarrassment that they never dared to ask a question about something unless they were absolutely certain that they were not prying into areas which might cause emotional distress. My friends knew nothing about Connie and felt, therefore, that they had to be careful what they said, just in case it turned out that her father had been eaten by wild pigs, or that her mother was a Jehovah's Witness, or that her brother thought he was the Duke of York, or that she herself had attended a Nazi confectionery college, or had just started an affair with my uncle. The middle-class mind was endlessly creative when imagining potential pitfalls. So I explained to Connie that she needed to send a green light by, for example, talking about her father in a relaxed manner for a few seconds. Then I said the queries about him would start flooding in. But what struck me as odd was that I'd been acting on this understanding all my life without ever having brought it to consciousness. As the French and the Paraguayans say, a fish does not know the water that it swims in. And 18 years later, when I was writing A Fish Called Wanda, I used this realization when Archie is trying to explain to Wanda the social straitjacket from which he is desperate to escape. Wanda, do you have any idea what it's like being English? Being so correct all the time, being so stifled by this dread of doing the wrong thing, of saying to someone, "Are you married?" and hearing, "My wife left me this morning," or saying, "Do you have children?" and being told they all burned to death on Wednesday. You see, Wanda, we're all terrified of embarrassment, and that's why we're so dead. Most of my friends are dead, you know. We have these piles of corpses to dinner. So Connie spent time trying to get to grips with English ways, learning to navigate London, going to auditions, practicing an English accent, and cooking me delicious dinners, while listening as I read out what Graham Chapman and I had written earlier in the day. I linked up again with Graham once I got back to London. We were immediately contacted by the producer of Marty Feldman's new TV show. Marty had attracted a great deal of attention in the television world during the second series of At Last the 1948 Show, and had now been offered his own series by the BBC. In retrospect, it surprises me that I cannot remember experiencing any feelings of envy or competitiveness at his rapid promotion. Perhaps it was because I'd done so many programmes in the previous year and a half and wanted a break from all that stress and responsibility. Perhaps it was because, as Marty seemed so much older than I was, I didn't feel competitive in the way that we usually do with our contemporaries. Perhaps it was because I totally understood why Marty wanted a show over which he had overall artistic control, and I felt that I too could probably get one when I was up for it. Or perhaps it was because Marty's producer, Dennis Main Wilson, now craved an audience with Graham and me, and taking the art of flattery to unprecedented heights or depths, cajoled and beseeched us to write for the show, which, without our material, he assured us, was certainly doomed to failure. This was Dennis's standard MO. Sometimes I find that taking a break from writing makes me more fecund once I return to it. And now Gray and I wrote Marty 30 minutes of material in record time, which was received ecstatically by, who else? Dennis Main Wilson. Our package included what we thought was an outstandingly funny skit with Marty as a disorderly Archbishop of Canterbury badgering passengers in a railway carriage. Graham and I attended the first recording of the series, and it was a great success, due in part to some spectacular film sequences. Marty's cast included Tim Brooke Taylor and a very suave former schoolteacher called John Junkin, who played the Cleese-type cold-blooded authoritarian swine roles. Meanwhile, I had a meeting with David Frost, who seemed to have become my patron, guide, and chief employer. And at one stroke, he removed all the financial anxieties that normally accompany a freelancer's life. I explained to him that I hoped to spend most of the year writing rather than in TV studios because I didn't want to leave Connie alone for long periods until she'd found her London feet. And I knew that this would suit Graham well because he decided to take a break from his medical studies so that he could get enough money together to pay his previous year's tax bill. David then asked me how much I thought I needed to earn, and I rather cheekily suggested £10,000, a sum that I reckon would be more than sufficient to allow Connie and me to trot along very comfortably. David's response to this was to commission two programmes on the spot. The first was a film idea Graham and I had cooked up about a detective agency that would feature Ronnie Barker, Ronnie Corbett, Marty, Tim, Graham, and me. The other, which was David's suggestion, and which I jumped at when he said he was happy for Connie to perform in it, was to be a special for American TV. With my finances now secure for the next year, Graham and I settled down to write. we decided to focus on the special first and came up with a title we liked, How to Irritate People. We swiftly established that because of his Marty commitments, Tim was not going to be available, so Graham and I gravitated instead towards using a Michael Palin, for reasons I can't recall. Certainly neither of us had ever acted with him before. He accepted our invitation and then provided the story for one of the pieces we wrote about a garage owner who'd sold him a car and who had a wonderfully evasive way of dealing with the numerous complaints that Michael made about it. This Mr. Gibbons, odd that the maiden name of Helen Palin, Michael's wife, was Gibbons, assured Michael that the reason the gearbox was a bit sticky was because the car was new, and he explained that the bit sticky gearbox was in fact characteristic of a high-quality car for the first 2,000 miles, and indeed one of the surefire ways to tell that you'd not been sold a lemon. When Michael later had trouble with the brakes, Mr. Gibbons told him that this was again because the car was new, but that if he ever had any brake problems, he should bring the car in. Michael pointed out that he was having such problems, which is why he had brought the car in, to which Mr. Gibbons retorted, "Well, if you have any further problems, Mr. Palin, you'll be sure and bring it in." Graham and I adored this man's cast of mind. It reminded us of Lloyd George's observation of the Irish Republican politician Eamon de Valera, that arguing with him was like trying to pick up mercury with a fork. We wrote a concise sketch about Mr. Gibbons, which we had to film as it involved car doors falling off on cue. The occasion of that filming was the first time that Graham and Michael performed together. It's well known among Python fans that this piece was later rewritten as the Dead Parrot sketch. What happened was this. How to Irritate People was never intended to be transmitted in the UK, so when Monty Python started, and I happened upon a copy of the script in a bottom drawer, Graham and I decided that something should be made of it, because no one in Britain had ever seen it, because we still loved the Gibbons character. We also felt, though, that having him as a car salesman was very clichéd, so we rummaged around amongst other possible locations for him, and up popped a pet shop. Obviously, someone had brought a pet, and there was something badly wrong with it. It was dead? What animal, then? A cat? No, dead kitties are not funny. A mouse wouldn't work, too small, too vulnerable. Something big. A dog? Could work, but people are fond of dogs. Imagine banging a dead dog against a counter to wake it up. You could get lynched. A parrot? Ah, yes, nobody's going to get upset about the death of a cartoon creature like a parrot. Except perhaps its owner. The rest of us couldn't give a monkey's. So out came Roger's thesaurus, which should have had a co-writer's credit on several of our sketches, and we were away, except that when we finished, it didn't quite work. Why? Something wasn't right with the pet shop owner's responses. The balance between his evasions and his outright lies didn't build properly, so it wasn't convincing. We had to rewrite his lines twice more before we were happy with them. Strange to recall, when Michael and I performed the sketch in front of the Monty Python studio audience in 1969, the reaction was quite subdued. I believe about 5 years elapsed before it mysteriously morphed into a classic. But I suspect it was performing the Dead Parrot on stage at Drury Lane in 1974 that somehow started its elevation to iconic status. Where was I? Oh, yes, writing How to Irritate People. It's funny how I drifted off that subject. Probably because, to be quite honest, it was not a good experience. Or, to be completely honest, it was a dreadful experience. But not when we were writing it. For the early stages of its gestation, Graham and I reveled in the freedom of being in charge of the script for the first time. We particularly enjoyed writing a sketch based on our favourite Indian restaurant, the Narain, just off the Oscourt Road. The owner, Bill Narain, had taken to greeting the two of us in an absurdly grandiloquent manner. Graham was always the good doctor, while he insisted on addressing me as my lord. He combined this extravagant fawning with self-abasement, apologising for his humble establishment and the ineptitude of his staff and the inadequacy of his chef, lamenting some imaginary problem with our last meal and promising to redouble his efforts on this visit while ushering us to our table with flamboyant gestures and cries of delight. Had we asked him to carry us to our chairs, he would have obliged instantly. When our triumphal procession finally reached the table, we would manage to seat ourselves despite his frenzied assistance and laudatory exclamations, at which point he would suddenly discover a grain of salt on the tablecloth, emit a roar of fury and despair at this latest assault on his guest's sensibilities, launch elaborate but savage denunciations at the waiters cowering round us, encomiums of praise for the good doctors and my lord's gracious forbearance, heartrending prayers for our forgiveness, and bloodthirsty threats of vengeance against one poor waiter who was now scuttling terrified towards the kitchen bearing the offending molecule of salt. Then there would be just a moment's pause in this extraordinary hullabaloo as he gathered himself for yet another outburst of frantic toadying, only to realise that he'd forgotten to give us the menus. His consequent howl of despair would have frightened a banshee, and the waiters had to restrain Bill as he tried to commit suicide by beating himself about the head with a drinks trolley. Perhaps I'm exaggerating a little, but only towards the end. Graham and I were initially embarrassed by Bill's displays, but after a time we agreed to enjoy and indeed encourage them to the extent that one evening, as we made our way to our table, Bill so surpassed himself in his outrageous fawning that half the restaurant stood up in acknowledgement of our apparently aristocratic status. As we wrote the sketch, we felt that we were creating only a pale shadow of the original. Graham was playing the diner, and Bill was played by Michael Palin.
Good evening, sir. Good evening, madame.
Good evening.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Please forgive me. I should have welcomed the madame first. No offense to you, sir. I am so stupid. Let me take a coat.
Well, we don't have any.
Oh, dear. Oh, that was no reflection on your dignity. Why should you have coats in this day and age, monsieur? Let me take something, though. Let me take a tie. I will have it pressed. Although I do not mean it is creased, but I will have it pressed. Oh, press your suit. Oh, but I am forgetting her ladyship. She is looking radiant tonight. Oh, what have I said? She always looks radiant. Oh, what a fool. I could kick myself. I will kick myself. Oh, such a fool am I. Oh, now, what am I doing? What have I done? I am so full of idle chatter, I have not set you down. Please, to sit down here. Your ladyship here, please. The chair is very clean. My staff have been licking it clean all day. Is it clean enough?
Yes, really.
If not, I shall lick it clean for you now. Please allow me.
No, really, it's very clean.
And you, my lord, is your chair clean? Oh, la la, there is dust on it. Oh, don't touch. Jamshid. Oh, the shame. Jamshid, there is dust upon this chair. Take it out and burn it. But first, unwrap a new chair and give it to my lord here. Oh, my lord, you are visiting a big star. Excuse me while I punish myself. My lord, here's your chair. Now, voila, the menu is your worships. What? Oh, what have I done? What have I done? I've given the princess a menu the wrong way up.
Do you recommend the Madras chicken curry?
It is wonderful, but for you it will be...
Is that hot?
Yes, it is hot.
Oh, I don't like it too hot.
Oh, no, not too hot. It's not hot at all. No, it is extremely cool.
Ah, well, because I like it medium.
Medium, that's what it is. Very, very extremely medium. It is medium beyond belief. Your Grace, let me wash your feet.
No.
Let me lick them then. Oh, dear, I am neglecting that Imperial Highness. What a baboon I am. What a fiend. What a festering sword I am. Please do stab me with your fork, Your Majesty.
No, really, just one Madras chicken.
Oh, then please, I must be flambéed alive. First the brandy, now set fire to me. Celestial being, I must be punished. Also, I shall be delicious.
And I would like a prawn dancer.
And I must do it to myself. The fork. And now, open the oven, Jamshid. I must jump inside.
Food's not terribly good, but the atmosphere's different.
I suspect that nowadays, Michael's portrayal of Dear Bill would not be allowed. It's okay to portray Germans as militaristic, or the French as snotty, the Italians as histrionic, the English as uptight and asexual, the Swedes as depressed, or the Swiss as money-grabbing. But political correctness deems that some nations are too vulnerable to tease, an attitude which strikes me as rather condescending. Perhaps when there are a few more Asian billionaires, Indians too will be regarded as permissible comedy fodder. Incidentally, Bill's food was the best we ever found, and there was no charge for the cabaret. The one and only sketch Graham and I wrote for the show that, judging from internet viewings, seems to have stood the test of time, concerns two airline pilots who become so bored on a long-haul flight that they decide to amuse themselves by making ambiguous announcements to frighten their passengers.
I spy with my little eye something beginning with S.
Sky.
Mm-hmm.
I spy with my little eye something beginning with C.
Cloud.
Yeah. Oh, God, I'm bored.
I'm fed up with that game. Let's play another game. I know what.
What?
Hello? This is your captain speaking. There is absolutely no cause for alarm.
That'll get us thinking.
No, not yet. Let it sink in. They're thinking, what is there absolutely no cause for alarm about? Are the wings on fire? The wings are not on fire. Now they're thinking, why should he say that? So we say...
Oh, how are we doing?
They've stopped eating, looking a bit worried.
Good.
Hang on, one of them's going to the washroom.
Is he there yet?
He's just closing the door.
Now!
Right. One, two, three. Please return to your seats and fasten your safety belts immediately, please.
Here he comes, going up the aisle like the clappers. I'll do the worried walk down now.
Right,
worried
walk. Right. Safety regulations.
Safety regulations.
Please listen carefully. I want to remind you of some of the safety regulations. In the case of emergency, it is vitally important to... as the warning buzzer sounds.
Oh, that's got them rattled.
Great, great.
Go.
Hey,
I've got an idea. Hello? You will find your life jackets under your seats.
No, they're on the right.
Shh. Let them scrabble a bit. I'm sorry, you will find them on the racks above your head. But do not unfasten your safety belt.
Great, great. That was marvellous. You should see them.
Right, gobbledygook.
Oh.
The scransoms above your head are now ready to flange. Please unfasten your safety belts and press the emergency photo scamps on the back of the seats behind you.
Marvellous milling about, climbing over the seats.
Please find the emergency sprill in the washroom at the back and release it.
But do not unfasten your safety belts.
That's got them back to their seats.
The emergency sprill must be released.
But do not leave your seats.
Do not panic.
Tea will now be served.
Inflate your life jackets.
And extinguish all cigarettes.
Please remove the luggage from the racks above your heads and place it on the racks on the other side of the aircraft.
Except the hand luggage.
Which you should sit on.
Now the look.
Hang on.
What?
Hang on.
What?
They've all jumped out.
You know, I wouldn't be surprised if there wasn't some trouble about this.
In a couple of cases, Graham and I opted to reuse sketches from the 1948 show. One, a game show spoof, with me as a heartless host called Nosmo Claphanger, haranguing an old crone. The other, a send-up of a current affairs interview about freedom of speech, where the interviewer never stops talking so that the interviewee, unable to get a word in edgeways, goes berserk. When I watched the whole show on DVD recently, I was startled to find that the performance Graham and I gave of freedom of speech was far weaker than the one Marty and I had done the year before. I was also surprised by the naturalistic style of the whole programme, much closer to the Frost Report, I felt, than to the 1948 show, and without a trace of anything Pythonesque. Considering the artistic control that Gray and I had, this may seem very odd, but I suspect it was simply the result of having the theme of irritation from the start, which encouraged us to remember what irritated us in ordinary life rather than to indulge in wilder flights of fancy. In addition to the sketches Graham and I wrote for the show, Connie helped me write a couple, the first time we'd ever worked together. One of them drew on her amusement at the way in which the English upper class avoided the pronoun I as though there was something vulgar about using it. I'd already noticed that using one instead of I seemed to convey a sense of magisterial detachment and imply that any person not in total agreement with one's personal view must be dreadfully common. I therefore wrote a sketch in which a young upper-class couple on a date achieved the highest degree of verbal intimacy considered permissible by their class. The setting is a fashionable Knightsbridge restaurant. At a romantically lit table sit an upper-class pair, Simon and Fiona, deep in conversation. Simon takes Fiona's hand tenderly. When one's with one, darling, one feels one's one.
One's one what?
No, one's at one.
Oh, at one with oneself.
No, at one with one, Fiona smiles.
One so agrees.
Simon looks deeply into Fiona's eyes. One loves one, darling.
One loves one too.
She kisses his hand. Where was one, darling?
One was saying one's wife didn't understand one.
Apart from the naturalistic, distinctly non-Pythonesque tone of How to Irritate People, there were other surprises for me as I watched the show for the first time in many years. I had no idea, for example, that I would discover another nascent Python sketch, this time in a far more recognisable form than the dead parrot. The job interview, which appeared slightly rewritten in the fifth show of the first Python series, as an interview for a place on a management training course. Then I was astonished to find some proto-Python pepper pots. These were Graham's creation. Women who hooted and squawked and made pensive chicken-like noises and in Python tended to discuss Jean-Paul Sartre or Mrs. William Pitt the Elder or the provenance of escaped penguins perched on their TV sets. He called them pepper pots because he felt their shape resembled that of the cheap plastic pepper pots to be found in works canteens. In How to Irritate People, we had them talking during a film. Not very funny at all. But the biggest surprise of all, in fact it was a shock, was to realise just how poor the show was. And then I remembered in ghastly detail the truly horrendous day we recorded it. Up to that moment, there'd be no sign of danger. We thought the script was pretty good, and Michael Palin remembers the read-through on the first day of rehearsal as being a bit of a riot. But from the instant we arrived in the studio that morning, everything went wrong. There were endless technical problems, which put the crew under such pressure that they never laughed at any of the sketches. We therefore found ourselves rehearsing to total silence, never an encouraging experience, especially when you're performing new material. Worse, we got only halfway through the dress rehearsal before time ran out and the audience started arriving. Things didn't improve when the warm-up man went on stage. He failed to get a titter out of the audience. And when I went out to thank them for coming to the recording, I was struck by their resemblance to the people in Weston-super-Mare on the day George VI died. My solar plexus tightened. I could feel the cold sweat coming. Then we started recording the show, and it was quieter even than a matinee I had once experienced in Dunedin. At least there they had teacups to rattle. And now it really began to go downhill. Within 5 minutes, none of the sketches felt funny, and this spells disaster for a performer. You just can't sense how to make the material funny because it just suddenly becomes clear to you that it isn't. One moment stands out as being especially appalling. Connie and I have sat down and are doing the ones sketch, and I sense a stirring in the audience, just as though they've all awoken from a thousand-year sleep. A tiny flicker of hope flashes through my central nervous system. "Hold it!" cries the director. "What? Why?" "We aren't told, of course." Silence. A minute passes. "From the beginning, please." So Connie and I started again, and just as we reached the same point, the audience stirs again, and we even get a tiny laugh, and the director intervenes. "Hold it, please." Connie and I stop and sit there for 7 minutes while they relight. By the time we start a third time, we can feel the audience's boredom and irritation, so I tighten up, the sketch lays a complete egg, and we have to cut it from the show. It's a nightmare once comedy stops feeling funny. I remember that when we did our first Python stage shows in 1973 on our tour of the UK, the first two performances in Southampton and Brighton went really well. But when we moved to the Bristol Hippodrome, the matinee audience there proved so unresponsive that they reminded me of the story of an actor who, pausing by a fishmonger's while doing his shopping one morning and surveying the fish lying on the slab with their open mouths and dead eyes, suddenly exclaims, "Oh, my God, I've got a matinee today." You can sometimes console yourself with the thought of, oh, it's just a bad house, but the complete silent apathy of this particular Bristol audience rattled me. Maybe it was because we'd only done the show twice before, but I now started to think, oh, my God, it's not funny. And for the rest of that performance, I stood in the wings or listened to the PA system in my dressing room with a sinking feeling, becoming ever more convinced that our show was a flop and dreading the humiliating tour that still stretched ahead. That night, however, the audience laughed from the first and my fears disappeared like a rat up a drainpipe. What had I been thinking? Of course it's funny. Listen to the audience. Unfortunately, there was no moment during the recording of How to Irritate People when it felt funny. It was an awful experience, and I felt bad that Connie had had such a terrible television baptism. I crept back to my burrow, vowing that I'd never take on such a project again, ever.